Richard Gilliland is joining us this morning. And good morning, Richard.
Good morning.
It's good to see you. Good to have you on the show. Richard, we're gonna go straight into the conversation, and we're gonna cut to music in a little bit when we get it all hooked up and back up and running. So tell me a bit. Who are you?
Well, I guess I'll give you two answers to that. The first one is the...
If you only have two...
two long ones, maybe. The first one is how I guess I'd want myself introduced in a lecture or something like that. I'm a scientist. I'm a dad and a husband. But I think my wife understands that I'm foremost a scientist married to my work, trained as a chemist and PhD in chemistry, and but I've worked here at Cornell at the High Energy Synchrotron Source with biologists and physicists and engineers and just every imaginable technology, and it's just this wonderful place. It consumes pretty much all of my time and thinking. Maybe a lot of people, I have, I'm kind of writing a book, you know, a book that'll maybe never get published, I don't know, or maybe
is that called your autobiography or your memoirs?
Yeah, sort of, yeah. And it's a file I add to, I've been adding to for many years, maybe 15, 20 years now, and I wrote a preface which was sort of a who I am, which is sort of a little bit more poetic, and I thought maybe I'd read that
sure,
this morning.
Sure, go ahead.
There are at least, 100,000 or more Richards in the United States. I haven't checked the statistics. Quite a few more worldwide. But I'm just some Richard who lived in the 21st century. I'm part of my mother and part of my father and my brother and part grandparents. It's their chemistry that I inherit, along with the chemistry of over a million years of human struggle and triumph. I am made of my wife, whose voice and thoughts will be in me for as long as I have thoughts. I'm made of my son, whose mind and self I watched form before my eyes. I'm made of the teachers who taught me in school, the actors I've seen on television and heard on the radio. I am made of the books I've read and the minds I've worked for. I am partly made of the hundreds of people I have known closely in life, and they live within my mind. I am a process, not a thing. I am not the same as I was yesterday, nor will I be the same tomorrow as I am today. I am as long as my process keeps running, but I will forever be a part of everyone I have touched in life and everyone, I hope, who reads the words that I write.
Wow. Wow. That is the most... poetic and thoroughgoing response to the "Who I am" question, "Who are you?" question that I've gotten. The other one that came close was from actually an evangelical pastor who was talking about his being a connector, a person who connects with others. He was describing being the connection rather than the product of the connection or the process of the connection. Interesting. And living in your thoughts and your words, and I would hazard a guess also in your muscle memory and in your heart, your emotions as they're stored in your mind.
I haven't usually thought about muscle memory, and I know you've brought that up in conversations we've had, and it's an interesting new idea for me. Mm-hmm. I do think, you know, I consider myself a very rational person as a scientist. Mm-hmm. But I'm also a very emotional and a passionate person, and I look at the world, through those two lenses, so to speak, and like everybody, balancing, trying to decide which of those things should have primacy in the particular moments in life where we are. Muscle, the physical aspect, it sort of reminds me of this book I read recently, Don't Be Such a Scientist.
Whoa.
I made some notes here of different books. That's the one I forgot to write down the author. Yeah. The guy was a PhD biologist. He had a tenured position as a professor, cushy position. But he just got this desire to be in the show business, to make movie productions, and work with actors. And so he left his secure academic position and went to train with in Hollywood and to, you know, learn the art of movie making. And he talks in his book from this perspective of learning all about communication and emotion. And he mentions that sort of idea that there is, you know, in addition to our rational thinking and our emotional thinking, that there is this body, this very sort of deep physical thing, which mm-hmm. which communications and advertising has learned to utilize. And scientists are very poor at that, amazingly poor sometimes at communicating. But they are passionate people, I think. They're really, you know, at the synchrotron, we run 24 hours a day when that machine is running. It's a costly machine, and scientists come in teams, and we squeeze every moment of X-rays out of that device for scientists all around the world. But it's a wonderful place to see the people who are passionately devoted. They just you know, there's no time for sleep mm-hmm, because mm-hmm. the questions that they have on their mind, which they feel are very important, not just to them but to humanity, they want to know the answer, and they have prepared samples which, you know, they've spent long months sometimes anticipating these things. And you see that, you know, there is a lot of passion and emotion there, and they don't always communicate it, you know, in all the technical jargon and stuff.
Well, I guess, having been around people with that kind of life and experience, the passion is almost contagious, even if they don't particularly communicate on it or dwell on it. To be so driven is almost to be swept up into that movement, that intensity. Even if you get families where people can't even understand what their partners are saying, are kind of taking the third or fourth translation and trying to get on board.
Yeah, I think they realize that there's a sort of a love, really. You know, you're kind of in love with it, as mm-hmm. as we are in every different, many different aspects of our life. You know, we fall in love with something, and we devote, you know, we spend ourself on that, invest in it.
Right, right. That's really, really, really neat. One of the things that you have just said is you know, what we fall in love with, what we invest in is what we've fallen in love with. And maybe I'm riffing it a little too much. But given your background, what experience, that seems like a pretty defining statement. And so what experiences have kind of led you to that realization? That's not a statement that I hear from a lot of people.
Well, Before we move on to that,
come on.
I'm looking for the right moment to share. Again, you know, I'm happy to explain rational things and science and all of that. But I really have come to appreciate there are better ways to communicate how we feel about things, and it's important to communicate how we feel about things. And so, I mean, late one night, I was. You know, home from work, and I just felt like I wanted to write poetry about how I felt, about how I felt about work. And so I sat down and I wrote a poem, which I'd like to read to you this morning. And I call it A Meditation on the Structure of Life. From all the corners of the earth, the tiniest specks of precious treasure cargo come to us, prepared for months with labor and anticipation. There is no time for prayers or mighty temples, or even for sleep, for that with searing brightness peers into the depths of creation's heart to see within a mote of dust, as if standing from the mightiest windswept peaks, the vast and endless deep, the infinite broad expanses carved by the winds of time, sorted by the endless cycle of life. The spires of mighty cities rise within a mote of dust. We stand in awe, for there is no right response but silence.
Yes.
Haven't used that in a lecture yet.
But you could. But you could. I have a friend who's a professor in the engineering school who has used, because they work on providing clean water to people around the world, a lot of it has to do with their motivation and their motivation to get it right at a low cost and work with the principles of engineering in a way that, that just makes it water available to people who could not otherwise afford it and maintain it. So I see that kind of wonder and awe when you're trying to work at the edge.
Yeah, I don't get to lecture in a traditional course.
Oh,
I do
right,
sometimes.
Yeah.
Well, I do. I visit. I was up at SUNY Upstate Medical giving a day lecture up there, and I really enjoy that. But I'm not really funded to teach.
Mm-hmm.
But we do. We mentor a lot of students. I have a postdoc, an undergraduate. I love working with undergraduates. I have for years and years, just doing projects and sometimes supervising a course project. But I really love kids, and we have kids. We're fortunate. The National Science Foundation is very, very serious about science education, and they allow us to fund a couple of, actually three, full-time teacher-like positions in something called the Exploration Station. And I'm sure many of the listeners out there have visited, taken their kids to the Exploration Station. And that is, man, what I wouldn't have given for something like that when I was a kid.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was just, that is a playground of science, all these wonderful gadgets there. But it's just a really renewing experience for me to, you know, to work with kids, especially little kids. It's just so much hope they're all just such beautiful people, and to try to convey, you know, the sense that we live, the universe is this wondrous playground. It's terrible and wonderful at the same
mm-hmm.
time, and it's just such a wonderful opportunity to explore and to try and convey to young minds some of the passion, the feeling of the privilege, the thankfulness. That I have to be living in this universe.
We're talking with Richard Gilliland this morning on the morning show, Made of Clay Report version, and you're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca. Richard, that is powerful and really, really neat to hear. One of my goals is to get people to talk about their passions, and to do so in a way that's personal and public that we don't often do here in Ithaca, and also to bring some of their music. So shall we switch to your music?
Yeah, let's do this.
So you want to announce the first one? You want to describe it?
Yeah, this is...
And there are two pieces. We're going to play them back uh-huh. to back.
Yeah, this is a classical music that has been reworked by Max Richter. It's sort of... I like Baroque music a lot when I was young. It's a bit of a cliche now. I don't listen to it very much, but I heard this piece reworked by it's Spring by Vivaldi that Max Richter redid as a minimalist piece, and it just really hit me. It's so hopeful and really expresses sort of my inner feelings. So I hope you all enjoy it.
And that was the first portion, and we're going to play the second portion here. that was Max Richter in a minimalist version of Vivaldi's Spring. And our guest this morning on the morning show, The Made of Clay Report, is Richard Gilliland, a research scientist at the Cornell Synchrotron. And Richard, it's good to have you here. Let's continue on now. We want to try to figure. What interests me about you and how we met was through the Ithaca Atheist Meetup. And one of my goals with this show is to introduce people to the many, many groups in this community and through the lives of the people who participate in them, so that it's a favorable introduction. And it's not necessarily, I don't mean so much the group or the politics, but I mean the person and how they've come to be who they are. And what brought you to Ithaca, what experience have shaped you? These are the kinds of questions that give an eye to who the person is. We happened to meet through the Ithaca Atheist Meetup, and that's a piece of you. That's an important part of you, but it's also not the only part of you. And how do you want to take on to the next step of the interview?
Well, you were asking sort of what moments defined me.
Yeah.
And I was thinking back kind of on my life. I grew up very religious. I still, you know, maybe might even call myself religious. My atheist friends would might take offense to that.
But, you have a very specific meaning in mind when you say that.
I have a very specific meaning, yeah. I grew up in a Christian denomination called the Reorganized, at that time when I was a child, called the Reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. And most people have heard of the Latter-day Saints, the Mormons, but our denomination separated from them 180 years ago.
Long time ago.
We're like night and day, and that church lived in the shadow of Mormonism as a small... what it was the group of the early Latter-day Saints right here in upstate New York, that when Joseph Smith, their leader, was assassinated, the church fragmented, and most of them went with Brigham Young out west, but a sort of a core bunch of them stayed behind in various points here and in the Midwest, fragmented, but ultimately unified by Emma Smith, Joseph's wife, and his oldest son, Joseph Smith III. And one of the issues that unified them back in the 19th century was polygamy or plural marriage, which they just simply could not accept in that new movement that was headed out west. And so they hung around and Joseph Smith III until he was old enough and a very reluctant leader. I think he had seen a lot of violence, a lot of turmoil, and he thought quite a bit differently than his dad, Joseph Smith. But he did eventually reunite the second largest, fraction of the early Latter-day Saint movement, and in a sense was a bit more of a skeptic. Although I think some of my church friends would. Might be surprised for me to characterize him that way.
There's a quality to those mid-19th century critical thinkers that, to some of them, that was not what we would necessarily call skeptical by modern standards, but they were incredibly analytic and suspicious and inquiry-based and a little bit anarchical.
Yeah, I haven't read a lot of the history what came after.
Mm-hmm.
But I think, at any rate, the reorganization, as they called themselves, lived a life of being, we're not the Mormons for most of their history.
I know, that's what I grew up around in Missouri, and their national center is in Independence,
yeah,
or,
Independence,
or one of their major...
Uh-huh.
That's their
world headquarters. Yeah. So I grew up in that church, and... my father is a minister, very much lay ministry. They have very few professionally trained ministers, almost entirely lay ministry, although they do have a small seminary now. And our church was very, my family was very deeply involved in the little tiny, isolated congregations, It is a very international church, but they're very, very isolated here in the East.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother was not a member of the church, which was a source of some stress, I think, in our family life. Her dad was a minister in United Church of Christ in small Midwestern towns. And I think he was actually, my mom, I viewed, she was much more interested in philosophy and so forth, and I kind of viewed her as just a little bit weird when I was a kid. You know, I was more in line with my dad's religious thinking. And what's really interesting is how I've switched sides and sort of come back now later in life to appreciating a lot of my mom's point of views. But one of the big things that shaped me, you know, as a child was also we lived with mental illness in our family, and you know, living with a mom who had mental health problems was very traumatic for me. Mm-hmm. But it also, I, you know, later in life, I've begun to look back and see the ways in which that shaped the way I interact with people.
Yes.
And my relationships, and the way I think even about mind and philosophical things.
Mm-hmm.
So that probably is one of the most defining things in my childhood was living through those times.
Right. What has living with a parent who's challenged with mental health issues, what has living with a parent made you sensitive to that you wouldn't otherwise be so, or don't think you would be so sensitive to?
Well, I think first and foremost, I think I had to, it gave me a challenge in life of sort of a certain insecurity when you have a parent and you don't know how they're going to, you know, during some parts of their life they're, you know, wonderful, normal people, and mm-hmm. during other times in their life they seem like a completely different person, and their personality has totally changed.
You don't know who you're going to get when you are with
right, them. And you're at the when you're a little child, you're really at the mercy of this. You really, and it's a big fear. But later in life, I began to understand too that we are as individuals what you think is your personality, what you think is who you are, is very much determined by your chemistry and by your body, and there are different parts of you that come out at different times. So it made me begin to think of mind and personality in sort of a more chemical way. You know, as understanding that we're, you know, we're not necessarily the individuals that we think we are.
So we don't necessarily know who we are, and we can't necessarily will ourselves to be something other than what we are, which we don't fully understand.
I think that would characterize.
That's almost like your poem, standing at the edge of the mystery of the forces.
Yeah, finding out what's when you really think about what's uniquely me. I mean, we know biologically that each of us have a few mutations here and there that make us uniquely us. But by and large, we get so much from the genetics of our parents, and mm-hmm. but also we're raised in a society with certain views, and we learn certain things. And you know, what is it that I'm really a collection of all of the people, as I said in my poem, that
right.
I've sort of been in
right.
contact with.
Right. And it, what I hear you not quite saying is that the edge of understanding softens judgment.
Yeah. Criticism. Oh sure. Oh sure.
And that quality of being able to carry more kindness is powerful.
Yeah, I think that the key to kindness is empathy, is having, you know, I think that humans have this ability, this wonderful ability to put themselves in someone else's shoes, to mm-hmm. think about, and when we experience things, you know, mm-hmm. they're not necessarily rational or reasoning.
Right.
We have emotional experience. We have things that happen to us. Those things, we, you know, when we're interacting with other people, we call them back to memory.
Mm-hmm.
And that helps us to have empathy. It helps us because we've experienced that.
Right, right. And I think well, the reason I kind of started there with judgment was my experience has been that to get to empathy, people have to suspend their judgment and then try. And then you begin to make those connections and stuff, whereas a stance that already is labeled a person doesn't allow you to see the evidence that might contradict what your assumptions are.
Well, I think we're incredibly good at suspending judgment, so to speak. I mean, it's very it's essential to be able to let's see, how can I put this? To be able to forget the details sometimes and work in generalities, that's really critical to our understanding. You know, to be able to that's part of what fantasy and what creativity are all about is
mm-hmm.
is dreaming for a moment. What if things are different? I think that we humans are actually very good at that.
But I think we can be very good at it. We can become stuck on it, which I think is the flip side. We can either be stuck with the details and never let go of all of the details, or we can be off in a fantasy land sometimes, which is not a good thing necessarily, or a good thing. I mean, these are mixed
yeah.
metaphors, these mixed experiences that have a positive and negative spin.
Getting back to you were asking me about defining moments.
Yeah.
I mean, the other really biggie was the birth of my son,
uh-huh.
and that was very much a turning point in my life, as it is in many people's. You know, this was here I was, had been a very religious, actively religious person. I was ordained into the lay ministry myself for many years, although I had lots and lots I had read lots of philosophy and had a very mechanistic understanding of the world around me, but my religion was very emotional. It was, so I lived sort of a compartmentalized life where it's easy to step into a different persona and a different, you know, you walk into a different environment with different people and you believe differently. And I believed that this, you know, birth was such an important moment in a person's life, having this experience with my wife, that it is a place where religious people talk about God being present with them and it changing their life and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a beautiful, beautiful birth experience where we had a midwife. We were in a hospital, though. We had a midwife. And I remember, you know, my son Max coming out and holding him. They handed, you know, while they cleaned up my wife, handed him to me, you know, and he was crying. And he stopped crying. I held him very close to my face. And he stopped crying and he opened his eyes and just looked me right in the eyes. And at that moment, I just had this profound realization of where our notion of God comes from, and how human it is that we have the ability to, in our minds, in our hearts, to look at another thing, another being, and have some sense of what we think they're thinking and how we think they feel. And I at that moment I looked and I thought, I am like a God to this little child. You know, I'm a dad, a father.
Mm-hmm.
And he will have the ability to look back at me and to have some sense of how I feel
mm-hmm.
and what I'm thinking. And that is what gives rise to our ability to believe in things like gods.
Right, or even in objectivity or larger concepts that we really cannot functionally or practically establish, but we can when we get beyond the limits of our technical understanding, we jump. And that's you jumped when you got pushed.
Well, I think we live with a lot of conflicts, and we mm-hmm. We have a rational mind and we know certain things, but we also have an emotional mm-hmm. self.
Absolutely.
And we feel a certain way about things, and those two things are not always together in unity. But this was a moment of unity for
yes.
me, in which I felt like my deepest inner feelings suddenly made a turn.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't learn until I started reading some philosophy. I did a biography of philosopher Daniel Dennett and learned that they call this philosophy of mind, mm-hmm. or intentional mm-hmm. stance is what mm-hmm. he calls
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I, for a long time, I was writing this book. I thought, this is the greatest idea ever. I'm the only person who knows this. And then started reading philosophy and realized there are other people that know this. So for me, that was both an emotional and a rational mm-hmm. moment in which my beliefs about the universe came into in synchronous with my rational mind.
And do you remember what your stance was, how you held the child, and what your physical response was?
Oh, absolutely. And I knew how important contact was. You know, I was very nervous, and I'm one of those people that gets cold fingers when you're very nervous. And I didn't want to touch him. It was like, I don't want to freeze him to death. They wrapped and bundled him up, and I held him as close, and I talked to him. And had as much physical contact as I could, because I knew how important that mm-hmm. is to little children to yeah. have that physical contact.
So it was one in all three of those ways: mind and emotion.
Yeah.
I mean, intellect, emotion, and physicality.
Yeah, yeah.
Wow.
So my wife and I are very different in terms of raising him, how we comfort. How we comforted him. He's a very colicky little kid. He's 20 now.
he's
over on the radio station over at WICV. But when he was upset, she would talk to him, because speech, mm-hmm. even if just babbling, was to her very comforting, and how you comfort. And to me, silence and physical closeness. Mm-hmm. And so I would hold him, I would rock him, but I would be very silent. I would be very quiet,
yes.
and because that's how I comfort myself. That's in the moments when I'm under stress or whatever. I go to a quiet place,
Neat.
So
for me, it's quiet and physical labor.
To all you young people out there having your first, congratulations, and enjoy one of the best times of your life.
Yes. Wow. So
anyhow, that was, I think one of the other things you were asking about was things that we've changed our mind about.
Yes, very much so. Let me do a station ID.
Yeah.
Where you're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca, and we're talking this morning with Richard Gilliland, a research scientist at the Cornell Synchrotron and a dad, and he's talking about his life, as we do on the Made of Clay Report.
So that's probably one of the biggest. Religion is one of the largest things that I've changed my mind on
mm-hmm.
over the years. And I think...
What's the change and how did it happen?
Well, in retrospect, once it's happened, you kind of look back and think, where did it, how did this happen?
Yeah.
And I think some people who have big changes in their life, it's traumatic. It's very traumatic. Mm-hmm. And I've actually come to empathize. And that doesn't mean whether you're leaving religion altogether or you're changing religions or moving into religion.
Or changing your stance with respect to a religion.
Yeah, it can be traumatic, because those are things which are really, really deeply held important beliefs.
Self, the mind, as you were saying.
Yeah, and they influence how we comfort ourselves, the expectations we have
mm-hmm.
about the future, all of those things. And when you leave something and move to another thing. Sometimes you look back and can be bitter about it. You can say, how could I have been fooled? You know, why did, how can everyone believe that and teach me that, you know, and now I know differently. And so, you know, and I see this both, in, you know, among atheists who have come out of Christian mm-hmm. tradition, but also among Christian folks who have changed, you know, like, for example, left Mormonism for a more evangelical church, feel have similar kinds of trauma that they
right.
experience when they change. I was fortunate in that, you know, my this change was both gradual and it never caused me to leave my church community. I suppose it, maybe if I were in a different religion, it would be much more difficult for me. But the reorganized Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints really liberalized enormously over the decades. Changed their name, decided they just didn't want to live in that shadow of Mormonism anymore, and they became the Community of Christ. They focused on community building. They have always prided themselves in being non-creedal, and so what you believe, there is a huge diversity mm-hmm. of theological belief. And in, you know, traditional folks who really value the Book of Mormon and the, all of that story, and as well as evangelical folks who have a fairly you know, mainstream mainline people, New Age individuals, you know, liberal progressive non-theists. Mm-hmm. You know, in the tradition, there's a, quite a following of John Shelby Spong in parts mm-hmm. of the church. And Tillich, and mm-hmm. and I thought, well, maybe even atheists.
And alas, it is so.
And I don't push it on people, and I have known so many individuals which I have great respect for, of diverse religious beliefs, and I have. Gained so much value from meeting them, not in a confrontational way, but finding a way to you know, to get to the core of what they believe is most important and translate. I mean, the process, you know, some atheists, there are three different ways that atheists view religion. One of them is sort of the Dawkins and Sam Harris type, where it's the trash heap. That's something that we've moved beyond as a society. It's time for the trash heap. And then there are the Daniel Dennett types who think salvage. This is a salvage yard. Religion is, there's some valuable stuff there.
It's bankrupt.
We need to take the parts. We've got to find the good parts. And then there are the gold mine folks, like maybe David Sloan Wilson and some of these individuals who believe that religion is adaptive, and it has all of these actually really beneficial things that we need to learn. So there are these three different categories, and I sort of placed myself somewhere in the salvage slash gold mine category. But constantly, as I sit in religious services, translating the, you know, when I go to, they have an annual reunion. Which I sometimes have gone to, and when I go to some activity like that, I gravitate towards what I feel is the core, most powerful part of that religious movement. And in this case, it's the early morning prayer and testimonies, where a small group of people come together to share, you know, their years' worth of trials and tribulations, where they create a very safe space where they can let those emotions, has a lot of crying, a lot of emotion, mm-hmm. a lot of really powerful inner feelings come out. And in the context of, for them, in talking about how a God relates to that. And I go there and I listen. And sometimes I share in ways that I'm able to share, but I listen. Because I want to know what the most, you know, what those really powerful things are and how that relates to what I now believe. How can I translate that, the things of value mm-hmm. that they see, mm-hmm. the valuable things that happen to them, how can I translate that into my worldview? So I live quite comfortably in the religious world, even though I consider myself a very hardcore atheist in terms of my rational beliefs.
And I don't think you're alone. I mean, in where I've gone to congregations and interviewed people in any length with any sense of confidence in the interviews, a good 15-20% would be or more in even fairly conservative Christian congregations are not particularly theistic. They have other ways of listening, other ways of hearing, other ways of appropriating.
It's not simple,
living,
is it?
And living in that language. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And one of the things that that is important is to kind of, and you've done it in a certain way, is you're trying to, in a sense, operationalize the concept of God. So you can try to figure out what they're saying and how you might bring it into your worldview. And for me, married to an atheist for 20 years and in relationship with an atheist now, I came to the statement, I don't believe in the God you don't believe in. And that's because for that particular atheist bent, it was more the number one group that you, this is stuff on the trash heap of history and we just need to empty it out and there's really nothing there. But there is something of meaning or value, and whether you call it God or not God, because God means so many different things to the people.
Yeah, I steer clear of using the term, and even when I'm participating in religious experience, I don't use the word God anymore. I realize that a number of my more progressive non-theistic friends freely use that term, maybe that's good. Mm-hmm. Maybe they're changing the meaning of it. But I find it that it's not necessary for me to, to convey what I want to convey. And there's a lot of terms that I'm learning, things like faith and so forth, mm-hmm. That I don't use anymore.
Right.
Because I've found better ways. And our language is amazingly, you become aware of how our language, our very language, is sort of built upon these notions of intentionality. Mm-hmm. Like when I say, if I say, I meet someone who's really good at something, I say, oh, they're gifted. Well, that implies a gift giver, does it not? And if you say talented, well, isn't that talents? That's like a biblical thing. The term I use is natural ability.
Or skillful.
Skillful.
Depending upon.
Yeah,
I actually find myself looking for words, but because of my particular work, I can't completely run away from the use of the God language, or the faith language, and have come to find other ways to do them. But you're exactly right. We've got to find ways to talk about these things, and they're going to be loaded because somebody's going to misunderstand, or we're going to say things that we don't intend to audiences that we cannot control. Communication is that way.
I don't want to. I'm concerned that if I start talking about referring to something as God, mm-hmm. that people they won't get the right idea about what I want to convey.
Right. Right. And so, and for me, what I end up saying is God or a reality beyond our comprehension and control, a perspective that is bigger than what I can actually bring to bear on this. But as you were gazing into the eyes of your son, you felt, and the son was gazing back, you felt an intimation that there was something.
I think for
there.
A lot of folks,
that's what I read into what you said.
God is, I find it easier to use the term sacred.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think for quite a few folks, God represents the sacred in this, whatever it is, mm-hmm. that something that is deeply meaningful to them, very important, that they want to hold up and
right.
say, this is the most important thing.
And it ties to what you're saying about the integration of emotion and thought. Because the sacred is also what is whole or holy. And that's another kind of play on words that gets at what something is deeply meaningful. It feels complete. And even in its paradoxes and its contradictions and its orneriness, it's meaningful.
One of the other questions sent me was you know, how do I find, I guess respect was the term used, or meaning, and I think a lot of people, you hear them talk about what's meaningful, mm-hmm. Or for example, there was this book some time ago, The Purpose-Driven Life, in evangelical circles, a very popular
big book.
So what does purpose mean to me? Because I think to the person who believes that there is a being in control of the universe, purpose is sort of, you're like a tool. You have a use, mm-hmm. and God has a plan for you. After thinking about that, I think that what people really mean when they talk about purpose and meaning is it's a way of saying, how am I of worth? How am I important to other people?
How do I matter?
Yeah, how do I matter? Right, is what they're really saying.
And both material and meaning.
Yeah, and so to me, it's like, okay, it's great that it makes you feel good to think that there is intelligent force running the universe and that being values you, but maybe it's a good idea to move beyond that and to think, what am I, how am I worth to mm-hmm. other folks?
Right. How do I participate? And to put it in language that makes the transition maybe easier, is how am I part of that force? Or how is that force part of me?
I think it's important to feel that we're a part of something larger. That's mm-hmm.
And that there can be a force without and a lot of people by God don't mean a separate thinking entity as a separate dimension or whatever, but they mean as a thoroughly integrated process by which we are caught up in and inextricable from, that we kind of need to wrestle with and that wrestles through us. But I mean, I'm taking us off on a slightly different tangent.
Yeah, I'm going to get lost here.
Yeah.
So let's see, where do we want
to
pick up?
You were talking about how you've appropriated, how you've listened to others in different ways. And one, let me just take a couple of seconds here. We haven't played much music, in part because what you were saying, especially at this time of year, where you are comfortable in your atheism and comfortable remaining in community with people whose experiences are radically different than your own, trying to find a way to listen, to take in what you can, and to be in some some way present to others who don't necessarily share what you valued, and to comfort. And one of the major lines for this season for Christians is, this is the season where you hear the passage, "Comfort, comfort my people, says your God." You know, and this is a season where people gather, oftentimes in family gatherings or in religious settings, where conflict is a major sub theme. And you're talking about comfort and comforting across one of those issues for which it's been a hard time for atheists to be in relationship with religious folk. It's been hard for religious folk to be in relationship with atheists. And you're sitting here saying, this is how I listen. This is how I hold.
You know, I had an experience with really touching. In the local congregation I sometimes participate in, I've been increasingly open. I've about my not believing that there's a intelligence that controls the universe. And a person, one of the individuals, came to me at one point in private and said, this time of year, this Christmas season, this is going to be a very sad year for me, because I lost my mom on mm-hmm. on Christmas Day, and this is the first year our family isn't together. And how do you view Christmas? And how do you, thinking sort of, as a non-believer, which is not quite the right term either, what do I get out of Christmas? And I had to think for a moment, but I was very touched that here is a person who, a religious individual, who valued my opinion from my point of view, because it might be meaningful to them.
Yes.
And I said, you know what I love is I love the lights. More than anything else. I mean, this is a couple of days ago, right? It was the darkest time of the year. And the little lights in the towns, the people put on the beautiful colored lights, and that just does something so wonderful for me to be reminded in this time of darkness, you know, the solstice and so forth, as people have in many different cultures throughout history, that the sun will return.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's going to come back. And we will get through this, and let's celebrate that light that mm-hmm. returns. Mm-hmm. And to me, that's the Christmas season and the holiday season.
And it's and as I watch you here in the studio, it's also the smile on your face and the sense of the satisfaction that one experiences without having to put a lot of detailed spin on it, other than that this is just the process of the world.
We got some more music at some point.
Yes, we do. We're gonna go to Twin Moons. We are so close. We're within about 6 minutes of the end of the hour, and because the conversation was so rich, I did not interrupt you as much as I might have for music or for other things. We're talking with Richard Gilliland, and this is the morning show on WRFI Ithaca, Watkins Glen, and. I've given him a few questions beforehand, and he has taken and done riffs with them, which have been wonderful, wonderful to hear. And I'm wondering, where would you like to pick up next?
Well, I don't know.
What
There's
do you do?
So many things.
Yeah, I know. And in this way, what this has been so rich, and in part because you take the words very seriously, and you make them sit in front. And sit with you and make them clear, and also make them in ways in which you own them or don't own them, or find them useful or not useful. And oftentimes guests are not that precise in that consideration. And so we've had some interesting walkings around. What I'm wondering, what do you personally do to restore yourself? What do you do to kind of keep yourself, to take care of that mind and that heart and that body, so that you are, in some sense, integrated and moving well in the world?
There's a number of things. There's actually a fabulous book, which I actually got to hear the person who wrote this book. It's called Coming Back, Rebuilding Lives After Crisis and Loss, Ann Kaiser Stearns. I don't know if you've heard of her or
no,
not.
I haven't.
And she interviewed a lot of people who had terrible, terrible losses in their life, but had managed to come back and become even stronger and even better people.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
My only complaint about the book is a little bit Western Christian-centric, but it was beautiful wisdom, and which I have kind of taken to heart in my own life in moments.
So what have you practiced?
And so one of the things that I do, especially when I'm working late at night, is I come back, and if it's a clear night, I will drive into my driveway, turn off the lights, and I'll look up at the Milky Way and the stars. And that is a constant, and it gives me perspective. I can realize, look up at that throughout my whole life. I've seen that scene. And it sort of allows me to pulls me out of myself and gives me some perspective. And to realize that the world is not all about me.
Reproportions you. Yes.
And the world is not all about me. You know, I think there's something I want written on my tombstone when I die,
mm-hmm.
and that is, don't worry, the universe is still young. Don't worry, the universe is still young.
Right.
That it's just getting going, and everything that about me that's wonderful, that I like, that or the people like, that's wonderful, that they'll miss when I'm gone, when I cease to work,
mm-hmm.
Is you know, was given birth to out of the universe in which we are a part. It came, and even better things are probably in store.
Right, and that attitude of humility in the face of the universe is one where you're going to find companions inside and outside religious communities and non-religious communities, because it's where we can meet and have a good conversation. And I feel like you've brought that here this morning. Thank you, Richard.
Well, you're welcome. Thanks so much.
And I want to cut, because we only have about 2 minutes left, I want to cut to play Twin Moons. Do you want to say something about that?
Well, it's kind of a romantic piece. And I don't usually listen in private to romantic pieces, but I just felt moved to, we've talked so much about relationships and children and so forth. Mm-hmm. And this is to all you lovers out there, just have a wonderful holiday season and just bask in that and enjoy this.
Our guest this morning has been Richard Gilliland, and we thank you. And we're about to close with Twin Moons, Medwin Goodall. You're listening to WRFI, Watkins Glen, Ithaca.